Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Adam Ragusea. At first, I just thought I'd been staring at my computer monitor for too long when the room started moving. And then I noticed the light swaying, and I realized it wasn't in my head.
So wrote listener Catherine from the sixth floor of an MIT building on Tuesday. Of all the things we thought we'd be talking about in today's Week in Review, an earthquake absolutely, positively was not one of them.
But it was only one of a few ominous rumblings that jolted what would normally be a quiet week in the dog days of August. Joining us now to round it all up is Boston Globe editorial page editor Peter Kanellis. Welcome back, Peter.
Thanks.
And we're also expecting in a moment to be joined by State House News reporter Kyle Chaney. But while we're getting him on the line, let's go ahead and talk about this interesting piece of news that came out from the Archdiocese of Boston. Victims of sexual abuse in the Catholic Church have long been clamoring to see internal documents relating to the investigations of priest abusers. And yesterday, finally, Cardinal O'Malley released a list of 159 priests accused of sexual abuse in the Boston Archdiocese, but there was a great big asterisk with that. Here's Terry McKiernan of Bishop Accountability on this program yesterday.
It's certainly good to have this list. You know, Baltimore brought out their list in 2002, LA in 2004, Chicago in 2006. The problem is that 62 priests that they know have been accused, that you and I don't know have been accused, have been left off this list.
Of course, Cardinal O'Malley said those names did not appear were of priests who had since died or were otherwise unable to defend themselves. He also left off the names of priests who belonged to orders like the Jesuits, who he says don't answer to him organizationally. Peter, you and the Globe have been on the front lines of covering the story for years. What does this all mean?
Well, I think it means that O'Malley is serious about turning the page. And, you know, it wasn't just the list. It was a comprehensive policy for sort of dealing with these cases going forward and exposing these names. I would say that while there is a kind of legalistic rationale for keeping some of those names off of the list, that the ultimate proof will be in the spirit in which the policy is implemented. You know, it might make sense to say if somebody who's already dead is accused of abuse and has no chance to defend himself, you know, why put that person's name out there? On the other hand, if you do investigate that claim and believe that it's credible and substantial, there's no reason not to put that name out there. And what we don't know now is whether the Archdiocese will sort of hide behind this policy and not reveal any of that information, or if they're going to use this policy as sort of a baseline from which they will go beyond it to reveal more.
What do you think about the Cardinal's claim that these orders like the Jesuits don't answer to him, and thus he washes his hands of them?
Well, I think that within the law of the Church, it probably makes sense. On the other hand, it's not very satisfying to people who are attending churches in the Boston area or going to schools in the Boston area if the abuser happens to be part of some other order, and that that case doesn't get investigated or exposed properly, and potentially people are left in danger. So I think what we should say and what we should expect from Cardinal O'Malley and from the Archdiocese is that they understand that they have responsibility for the safety of these kids, and they have to make sure that the other orders investigate these cases very diligently, and that anybody who could be a danger is removed. Now, they do say, I've talked to them this morning, and, you know, they do say that they reveal all of these cases to the proper authorities and refer them for further investigation, and they do investigate them themselves, but they have to clearly demonstrate that they're doing that.
It goes on and on and on and on. We are reviewing the week's news with Peter Kanellis, editorial page editor for the Boston Globe, and we're joined now from the State House by Kyle Chaney, making his Week in Review debut, reporter with the State House News Service. Welcome, Kyle.
Hi there. Good to be here.
Let's go to the Beacon Hill news, something that was sudden like an earthquake but hardly as surprising. After years of vitriolic debate, Governor Patrick and top legislative leaders sprang a fully formed compromise for expanding gambling in Massachusetts. Here's State House Speaker Robert DeLeo singing the song he's been belting out for years now. You know, we have to recapture the money we're losing to places like Mohegan Sun in Connecticut.
Right now we have a problem in Massachusetts where people are spending over $1 billion of their money that they earn here in Massachusetts out of state. But they're coming back to Massachusetts with the problem that they have with gambling addiction.
So now we'll have the money and the problems. The deal, if passed, would result in licenses for 3 casinos, one in western Massachusetts, one in southeastern Mass, and one in this broadly defined region that includes the North Shore, Worcester, and Boston. It would also allow for 1 video slot parlor, probably in one of the old closed dog tracks, a big victory for DeLeo, who has the Wonderland and Suffolk Downs tracks in his district. Kyle, this is, to my memory, almost identical to the deal that died on the vine last year. What makes this year so different?
It's very similar, but there is one key difference, and that is that the one slot parlor that would be created in this deal would be competitively bid for, unlike last year's deal. And that was this big sticking point for the governor, who said, I won't have any no-bid contract go to a racetrack. And so that being the key stumbling block, it's been removed. There really seems to be no disagreement among at least the big three in terms of what direction to head in, from a broad concept.
And the backers, of course, say that it's going to create 16,000 jobs, hospitality industry, dealers, performers, back office people, that kind of thing. But the other New England casinos continue to perform really wretchedly in this economy. So after all of the public debate around this, with this tiny little tweak that you described, Kyle, are Massachusetts casinos a fait accompli?
No such thing as a fait accompli. I think a lot of people might have said that last year, too, before things fell apart. I think what you're going to see, though, is not a lot of debate about the broad policy of expanded gambling, but really the fine points. Do we allow smoking in casinos? Do we, how do we deal with the Native American tribes seeking casinos? There will be extensive debate, but it'll probably be more on those finer points than the overarching concept of expanded gambling.
How fast do you think it could all happen?
It won't happen fast. I think they're going to try to move it fast because it does tend to suck up all the oxygen up here. But there are rules and processes in place that will probably stretch it out over the span of several weeks. The speaker said he'd like to see it done by the end of October, and that's assuming they start debating it in mid-September. So it could be 4 or 5 weeks that this thing's alive.
Peter Canellis, the gambling opponents have been out in force this week on WBUR and in your paper, but do you have any sense of some resignation on their part this time?
Well, I think the fact that all of the leaders of the 3 branches of government are on board for it, I think they feel like a defeat is in the offing. And so, yes, there's probably more concern, but it's not resignation in terms of acceptance. I think they're as dramatically opposed as they ever were. And I think that all of the legislative machinations we've seen and the difficulty in coming to consensus, and as Kyle was referring to, all the unresolved issues and sucking all the oxygen out of the room, has only sort of furthered that idea that gambling is something that is uniquely troublesome and difficult for a state to handle.
Well, they always said, though, that once the public knows the real cost-benefit analysis of expanded gambling, they'll reject it. And here we are, on the cusp of this happening. There was a referendum where the public voted for expanded gambling. What does it all mean that this is the result we're left with at the end?
You mean, what does it mean in terms of the opponents,
yeah,
or what does it mean for the state? I mean, in terms of the opponents, I think the opponents would say that a lot of the detriments aren't visible and aren't visible yet. And it comes in the form of political corruption. You know, all of these machinations can be undone by future legislatures. And, for all that we say, this is an open bidding process, and we have that zone that includes Worcester and Boston and eastern Massachusetts. Does anyone doubt that the casino is going to go to Suffolk Downs, by the way?
You mean the slot parlor?
Well, either the slot parlor or the casino. I think
want
the larger casino at Suffolk Downs. And, that has been DeLeo's overriding concern. Why is a representative from East Boston so evangelical on this issue? And it's because he wants to benefit Suffolk Towns.
Kyle, does anybody doubt that?
No, I don't think anyone doubts it. I don't think the speaker has quite denied that either. He does have a parochial interest in it as well as an overarching state interest. But I think to the point that Peter made as well, one thing that's happening simultaneously as this debate's about to kick off is the DeLeo's predecessor is about to get facing sentencing on September 8th on a political corruption charge.
Sal DeMacy.
Some of the gambling opponents are actually harnessing that and saying that, you know, political corruption is a reality in Massachusetts, and this gambling industry breeds that.
I see.
So that they're pointing to that as a big issue for them.
Well, gentlemen, let's go ahead and move on to the fake Twitter account du jour. First, there was the highly profane Rahm Emanuel account. Then we had the escaped Bronx Zoo Cobra. And now we have Crazy Casey, an account impersonating the voice of Democratic U.S. Senate candidate and City Year co-founder Alan Casey, who is hoping to take on Scott Brown next year. Here's a sample tweet.
Just got back from sunny California. Thanks to all the elitists there for donating to my campaign.
Thank you, Meghna.
You're very welcome.
Here are some other samples. In reference to the It Gets Better video made by the Massachusetts congressional delegation, from which Scott Brown was notably absent, Crazy Casey wrote,
I promise to devote all my time in office to making gay videos. Shame on Scott Brown for focusing on jobs.
And in response to a Boston University tweet about move-in season, asking people, what is the one thing you're glad you brought with you freshman year? Crazy Casey replied,
a bong.
And this week it was revealed that the brilliant, scathing, comedic mind behind the Crazy Casey account was not some Northeastern kid doing his co-op with the state GOP. It was, in fact, Peter?
Eric Fernstrom.
explain to the listeners who Eric Fernstrom
is. Eric Fernstrom is really the campaign mastermind behind Scott Brown, and also a very senior aide of Mitt Romney's for years, and a former reporter for the Boston Herald up at the State House. He has acknowledged this fact. I think that it reflects obviously badly on Fernstrom. It also reflects, somewhat badly on Brown and on Romney. But it also, like so much of what we've seen lately, it makes people very cynical about the process. It shows that by putting out these caricatures of certain candidates, political consultants can get a kind of subconscious association going. So I think it is effective. I think that, they're trying to present Alan Casey as an elitist, which he really isn't. But, it's nonetheless, they're hoping that by the time people actually focus in on this campaign, they'll already have a picture of Alan Casey in their mind before they hear anything from Alan Casey.
Yeah, but this is Alan Casey we're talking about. I think he's raised more money than all of the other Democrats fighting to take on Scott Brown, but he's not considered much of a contender. He fared very poorly against Martha Coakley the last time around, and he's being totally eclipsed by Elizabeth Warren right now. So why does a big-time player like Eric Fernstrom stay up at night personally taking down the likes of Alan Casey?
Well, I think they probably started doing it before Elizabeth Warren. It was more clear that she was going to run, and so they considered Casey the front runner back then.
Did they?
I bet they did.
Okay.
I bet they did. I mean, Seti Warren is running Bob Massey, but, Casey's probably better known than those two around the state and does have more money.
Well, Fernstrom got caught first by the folks at Blue Mask Group because he had accidentally posted one of these fake Casey tweets to his personal account. And then, as you mentioned, Peter, Scott Brown disavowed all knowledge of this and he condemned it. Fernstrom did not apologize. He said, if you can't stand the tweet, get out of the kitchen. Nonetheless, the account was deleted, I noticed, this morning, presumably by Fernstrom, because he would have had the password. So, Kyle, despite what Brown says, do you think that this was a deliberate campaign strategy, or was it just an extracurricular thing? Was he going rogue?
That's the million-dollar question. I think Democrats are relishing it a little bit because Fernstrom is a figure who's kind of bedeviled them for years on behalf of Romney and on behalf of Scott Brown. So I think anything that puts him in a bit of an uncomfortable spot, they'll take. And whether it was part of a deliberate campaign strategy, it's hard to say what really was behind it, but I guess that's the perils of Twitter these days.
Well, do you buy Peter's analysis that an offense like this could potentially be effective, or is it just funny red meat that you throw to your base?
I think if you think about it, sort of like the Saturday Night Live parodies of like Sarah Palin, you know, the difference here being that it's coming from one of the campaigns as opposed to a TV show. I think in some ways that kind of parody has proven effective and memorable to people. So the fact that it's Eric Fahrenstrom, I think, you know, reflects a little poorly on the campaign, but in the grand scheme of things, the parody may be more memorable than who actually was behind it.
I think that's completely right. The Kyle's completely right about this, and I think it is a recognized strategy among political consultants that they want to define their opponents early before the mass of people really know who these people are. And Alan Kazee is somebody who has a very idealistic, grassroots kind of approach to using volunteers to solve government problems. It's a real outsider kind of thing, but it is very starry-eyed, very idealistic. And he wants to sort of soil it before people really have a chance to digest it by creating this image of Kazee as an elitist who isn't in touch with the average person.
And it may be a window into that they were taking Kazee more seriously than maybe people were in the larger public. They view him as more of a threat. That he's a very sharp political consultant and may have been aware of things, vulnerabilities that Scott Brown had that Kazee could capitalize on that others hadn't seen yet.
Well, Fahrenstrom shows no signs of being taken down by this. Peter, I guess I'll ask you, why not?
I think that we've become so inured to these kinds of tactics that it's no longer scandalous. I mean, you remember back in the 1988 campaign when Donna Brazile was caught spreading a rumor about George Bush Sr., the Dukakis campaign immediately removed her. She was shamed. She was thrown off the plane, basically. Now, similar thing happens. It's 23 years later, and everybody kind of smiles and laughs and moves on.
Well, gentlemen, let's go ahead and move on to our hubbub. That's a story that maybe we didn't get to in the main body of the segment today, but is worth talking about. Meghna, what are you going to hubbub about today?
So my hubbub is going to bring together Twitter, as we were just talking about, and natural disasters, because there's this really ultra, ultra geeky comic strip out there called XKCD, and it's got huge fans. It's like line drawings that deal with complicated science problems. And right after the earthquake struck, the guy who wrote XKCD put out this comic that said, hey, based on the fact that a lot of people tweet within like 10 seconds of something happening, and then the speed of fiber optic networks versus the speed of how fast an earthquake travels, it is possible that people who felt the earthquake, say, in Ohio, actually got tweets about it before they felt the tremors. And so Wired Magazine did a test to see if the math works out, and it apparently does. So we have arrived in a time where the future is the present. So I want to know what Irene is going to do for us on Sunday. Now, Twitter, tell me.
That blows my mind.
Time travel by Twitter.
Exactly.
Kyle, what's your hubbub?
This week state officials kind of got a little starstruck over the prospect of a major Hollywood production being filmed in Boston. The movie that actually was confirmed to be on track to be filmed in Boston sometime, I believe, in 2013 is called RIPD. It's not Rhode Island Police Department. It's Rest in Peace Department, about a dead police officer patrolling the streets of Boston, played by Ryan Reynolds. And the movie also figures to bring other big stars, Jeff Bridges, Kevin Bacon, Mary Louise Parker. So interesting premise for a movie, but a big name cast.
Well, that's cool. Great. we can look forward to having traffic snarled by that one.
Well, now I'll have 1 degree of separation from Kevin Bacon.
Exactly.
Won't we all? Peter, what's your hubbub?
I think that it's struck all of us, the 10th anniversary of 9/11 that's coming up, but nothing makes that feel more vivid than the idea that the children of the victims are now so old that they're disbanding the summer camp that they all went to. And it's
Camp America, it was called?
Camp America in the Berkshires, and some of the kids were counselors, some of them were campers, but it was a chance for children who had lost parents in that deadly attack to bond with each other, to be in a place where they weren't identified as being unusual in any way. It helped them to grieve. And I think it's a moment to reflect on what a great project that was and how much help it did for so many hundreds of kids.
Peter, do you mind if I ask you a question? Because I know that the camp counselors have said it's because the kids are aging out. I mean, it's been 10 mm-hmm. years. But some of them are only, you know, 7, 8, 9. They don't seem that old. They seem that they could actually, like, benefit from several more years of having this community.
Well, they can't be 7, 8, 9 if we're at the 10th anniversary of 9-11. So,
the ones who are
1 are 11, and the ones who are 2 are 12. And so it becomes harder to fill the glasses, I think, over time.
They had expanded their mission to include kids of just fallen officers that weren't necessarily associated with 9-11. I'm surprised they didn't feel like they could just kind of keep that essential mission going, but I felt like they needed to wrap.
Yeah, I think that it's probably a model that's replicable in so many different ways for people who are victims of trauma and children who are victims of trauma. And, you know, some of the donors that were behind it, if they can find a way to broaden it out and keep the camp going, it'd be a great idea.
Well, finally, I'm going to hubbub about Christian Markley's video installation, The Clock, which it has been described to me as the Lady Gaga of contemporary art pieces, which is, of course, going to be opening at the MFA after some very successful runs in New York and L.A. In the middle of September. Peter, your paper, Jeff Edgers at The Globe, had reported that the inaugural screening was going to come with kind of a hefty price tag. The MFA shot back and said, no, that money is for the reception, and there was a big, big, big thing. And then eventually we got this update just this week, just a couple of days, just yesterday, I believe, that said that the MFA is going to go ahead and do a free screening right in advance, one day in advance of the screening that has the reception associated with it and the price tag associated with it. And what blows me away about this story is that it's once again an incredible demonstration of the power of the Boston Globe in this community. Peter Kanellis with said incredibly powerful Boston Globe. Thank you so much.
Thank you for that nod. That's great.
Kyle Chaney with the State House News Service. We appreciate it. We'll have you back again.
Appreciate it. Thanks very much.
Well, coming up in just a minute, burps and squirts, lip trills, and raspberries, they all combine to make beautiful music. Stay with us. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Adam Ragusea. This is Radio Boston.